You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell introduced new legislation to raise the legal age to buy tobacco products from 18 to 21. We'll learn more about the proposal and the reaction from public health experts. Now, school funding is one of the most high-profile issues in any state budget, but with Democrat and former state education superintendent Tony Evers now in the governor's office, Republicans and Democrats may need to work a bit harder to find compromises on education. In his budget address earlier this year, Governor Evers called for a boost in special education funding, limits to the voucher program, and a return to higher levels of state support for school districts around the state.
I've said all along that what's best for our kids is best for our state. Investing our kids will yield dividends for our future. So we're going to start with K through 12 education, providing historic investments and returning to two-thirds funding at the state level.
We're joined now by two members of the State Assembly's Committee on Education. Dave Considine is a Democrat representing the 81st Assembly District, which includes Baraboo. Representative Considine, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
And Romaine Quinn is a Republican representing the 75th Assembly District, including Barron County. Representative Quinn, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you.
Well, Representative Considine, let's start with you. I think it's not controversial to say the way our schools are funded in Wisconsin is complicated. You've said in the past that we should revisit the school funding formula, I think, that we use in the state. Where do you think it isn't working?
It doesn't appropriately balance the needs of students from urban and rural areas with those in suburban areas because of some of the very complex issues. Issues that came up because they were trying to balance funding for students across the state. And now, 30 years later, that's hurting those same students as we get sparser school districts that are not growing. That was a growth time in our economy and communities. We're all growing.
And Representative Quinn, do you think it's time to open up the hood and start tinkering with the school funding formula?
Well, we have been, right? I mean, we had the Blue Ribbon Commission, which was a bipartisan commission, made up of advocates from all over the place and all over the state. And we traveled the state talking to school staff, teachers, students, you name it. And we came up with a number of recommendations because I think it's pretty apparent to the public as well that what we have now could definitely use some improvement.
And Representative Considine, last year, then Governor Walker signed a bill that let smaller, lower spending school districts raise their property tax revenue. It made it a little easier for them to do that. It got some bipartisan support. Is that something you think will be helpful to schools in your district?
Yeah, that's somewhat helpful, but we need to do a lot more. Education funding is way behind, and especially for our rural school districts. We're just not the disparity between what some suburban school districts have and what is spent on their students and with what is spent in urban areas like Milwaukee and then rural areas. Very similar in a lot of ways and not funded appropriately.
And Representative Quinn, you mentioned that Blue Ribbon Commission you were a part of. What were some of the recommendations there that you're hoping that in this session, in this budget, you can take and run with?
Oh, how much time do you have? There's a number of issues that even some small tweaks could be a big deal, even going forward. You know, sometimes it's not just funding, but that's obviously a big component. You know, everything from, you know, bilingual aid. You know, I have the Barron School District, who has a very high population of Somali students, and it's getting better now in terms of their English. But when they first came here, that's a real struggle. You know, how do you find funding for special interpreters to help these children who never really had a school setting? You know, I heard from Abbotsford, same thing, half their school is of Hispanic descent, and it's very hard to find interpreters or take that out of your general fund. Declining enrollment. Representative Considine mentioned rural areas. You know, it worked good when we were growing and everyone had 10 farm kids, but those numbers are gone now. And when your funding's built off your per student enrollment, that's a big problem. So, you know, Representative Markline or Senator Markline and I have the bill for declining enrollment. We're hoping that can be wrapped into the budget too. So lots of different ideas and different approaches to try and, like you said, at the end of the day, address some of the disparities that exist across the state.
We're talking about Wisconsin's education budget, a big ticket item in the state budget negotiations this year. Two state lawmakers are with us, Assembly Representatives Romaine Quinn, a Republican, Dave Considine, a Democrat. Let's talk about special education. This is something that Governor Evers had talked about, as we heard in his budget address this year. A lot of schools saying, hey, we're falling behind on state support for special ed. It's creating a crunch in schools. Representative Quinn, let's start with you on this one. What do you see out there that could help schools when it comes to special education funding?
Yeah, and that was a topic that came up. It was an issue that we heard about as we traveled the state on the Blue Ribbon Commission, and that's why one of the recommendations, there was really no set number that we could all decide on, so we said, heck, we'll just pass everything in the legislature, and they decide at some point. So I don't think there's any controversy right now in giving a bump to special education. I think $600 million just in the special ed piece and not in the other pieces is a lot, because, I mean, frankly, I'll be honest, the $1.3 billion overall is just more than we can chew right now. And obviously there's disagreement on that. We'll have that debate. But I don't think special ed funding itself, since most of the time it's just a reimbursement of actual cost, is very controversial. So you're not worried about how do we tie funding to outcomes, because these are real costs incurred by school districts that we just didn't need to do a better job reimbursing. And Representative Constantine would know more than this, being in that field in his previous life.
Right. You're a former teacher yourself, Representative Constantine. What do you see when it comes to schools' needs for special education funding?
Yeah, I was actually formerly a special educator for 30 years. And special education has been mandated for all of our school districts without being funded for years. And that goes back over 10 years. We've mandated things and not funded them. And the only way to fund them was through local property taxes. And I'm excited that with the governor's budget, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau says that we'll actually have lower property taxes than we had in the last budget and still get that $600 million. And it's because that money is really already being paid by local property taxpayers. That's coming out of the local school budget. It's a matter of the state needs to pay for special education funding, not the local school district. And I think that will also help balance the urban and rural with suburban as we balance that funding out over across all of them, and the state funds that. And so I think we can do that without raising property taxes. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau says that they will be less than they were in the last biennium.
And Representative Constantine, we heard Representative Quinn mention the overall price tag for Governor Evers' budget when it comes to schools. A big jump. Some Republicans in particular saying, we all agree on some of the priorities here. The price tag is too high. We can't afford it. What do you see when you look at the overall increase in the governor's budget?
Budgets are about priorities, and that has been my shtick for the last 4 years. And I think we can have different priorities than Governor Evers in his budget proposed those different priorities. I'm not sure what my colleagues are going to do in the Joint Finance Committee and what's going to come out of Joint Finance. They're building from base, which they did under the last biennium with Governor Walker's budget. I'm hoping they consider a lot of the things in Governor Evers' budget as they propose their own budget, and then we get to work on it. But certainly, I think we can make it work. Governor Evers' budget is balanced, and it makes it work.
Representative Quinn, do you think it can work?
No, because I guess I don't know where the balance piece comes from, because the last numbers I've seen from Fiscal Bureau put us about $800 million upside down heading into the next biennium. So I think we can invest in schools. I want to invest in broadband. I want to do lots of different things, raise personal care worker wages, all that stuff. But it's all about balance and finding that sweet spot and figuring out what the state can afford. And that's the challenge that we have in front of us.
That said, Representative Quinn, do you see this as a thing that's going to be kind of a fighting tooth and nail scenario, or is there enough room for agreement that you see, hey, there's going to be some bipartisan agreement on education?
Well, I think there'll be bipartisanship on the education piece. We'll have to see on the overall budget. I mean, even if Governor Evers was honestly realistic that he could think he could get everything that he asked for in the budget, then I don't know if he's going to like what comes out, because there is just so much spending. I don't see it as sustainable. But on the individual issues, I think there actually is a lot of commonalities, especially on education, considering we had that bipartisan committee and Representative Kitchens and Senator Olson and myself and others have been trying to preach to our caucuses on these issues. Because remember, all schools are different. So there are schools in the state that are fine and do not need more money. And there are schools in the state that spend thousands less per student. And we're asking them all to compete and perform on the same playing field. Well, that's not okay. So again, now we go back and sit down and what's the best way to to address the challenges that our schools face going forward, not just the next 2 years, but fundamentally make some of those structural changes long into the future.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Democratic Assembly Representative Dave Considine from the 81st Assembly District, which includes Baraboo, and Republican Romaine Quinn from the 75th Assembly District in northwestern Wisconsin. We're talking about education, funding, and policy in the state. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the state's priorities should be in this upcoming budget when it comes to schools? How should we deal with things like teacher retention and achievement gaps and gaps in per-student funding between different parts of the state? If you are working in education, what do you see around you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, first of all, they need to restore the salaries that they took away from the teachers in Act 10. We've lost so many good teachers to early retirement, and we can't find teachers to come in to replace them. So teachers are a priority, and the Republicans don't value educators, and I wish you would learn to do that again, because that is what's teaching our future. Education has to be taught by people that know what they're doing. So I would like teachers to have their monetary value restored.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Representative Quinn, what do you say?
Well, I just don't think that's true that Republicans don't care about teachers. I mean, we're married to teachers. Our kids go to schools. I mean, we all want to see students succeed. So having a policy difference is different than saying you don't care about teachers. But, yeah, I absolutely agree. Schools, especially rural ones and different ones with different issues, need the funding to be able to attract teachers like other schools do. So if I have a school, even in my own district, there's big disparities. If I have a school that spends $11,500 per student, another one that spends $9,300 per student, how is that low-spending school ever going to compete to try and pay a competitive wage for a teacher? So, absolutely, teachers do a marvelous job. I could not be a teacher. Bless them all. And they deserve a fair wage for the work they do. But going into the whole Act 10 conversation, that's a topic for another day as well.
Representative Considine, what do you hear from your former colleagues? Do you see them wanting to get out of the business?
I see so much changeover in teaching. New teachers that are excited about coming into teaching and then 4 or 5 years later are moving out of the community. And Representative Quinn mentioned that they're moving to a higher paying district. That's the way they can get a raise nowadays, actually. I think the real problem, more than teacher pay, although I think we can address that somewhat, and I think school districts will, if we start appropriately funding schools, that will happen because school districts want to compensate their teachers. They're just not able to do it right now. I think the other problem is just the whole respect thing. The teachers don't feel respected. The caller alluded to that. And we have to restore respect for professionals in our state. I don't care whether it's corrections officers, teachers. They feel disrespected and not heard. And I think Governor Evers' budget, just because of the tone it sets, will help that kind of thing happen so teachers can feel like we really do respect them and what they do.
Thanks for that call, Cindy. Let's bring on Donna in New Berlin now. Donna, hello.
Hi. I'm a teacher at a middle school and high school in New Berlin, and one of the things I see that we are lacking is help with mental health issues. We have so many teenagers that are struggling with depression, anxiety. This affects them academically, it affects them socially, and we need help in order to help these students.
Donna, thanks a lot for the call. Representative Considine, let's start with you. Do we have sufficient resources in schools when it comes to what Donna's talking about, mental health concerns for students?
No, we don't. We have professionals who are trained to do that, but sadly, because of some of it goes back to financing again. Those teachers are doing scheduling and all sorts of other things, and they're trained to do counseling, and they're not in that field. They're doing other things. I especially think we need to get things at a lower level, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, first, second, third grade. We need to help with the mental health problems much earlier than Donna even suggests. And the budget starts looking at that and getting mental health into the schools. We've done a few things as a legislature and allowed private mental health places to come in. But the problem is there's not enough mental health providers in the whole state or in the nation.
Representative Quinn, do you see a need for this to be tackled in the budget in particular?
Well, and that's an issue as well as a recommendation of the Blue Ribbon Commission, too. So, I mean, how do you grade a teacher based on the improvement of a student when the student is struggling so mightily with issues, whether it comes from trauma or you name it, and not being able to have access to someone that can deal with that? So a big piece of it is providers. It's very tough, especially in northern and rural Wisconsin. Not many people are moving there. So we look at different programs all the time, student loan forgiveness. How do we incentivize more practitioners? You know, Mayo up in our neck of the woods is starting to allow for more psychiatrist training. And then, of course, even expanding a child psychiatry program to allow regular practitioners to call in and consult with psychiatrists to at least somewhat try to treat these kids when there is no one nearby. So it's definitely a need, but the big question is, how do you fund it? So do you do a categorical aid, another categorical aid specifically for mental health? Do you just give the school general aids and let them to determine, even though you were hoping it would go to mental health? So there's a lot of questions on not only just the funding piece, but how do you fund mental health and whose role is that and how do we get there?
Thanks for that call. We are talking about the state's education budget. Representative Dave Considine is here with us, a Democrat from the Baraboo area, Romaine Quinn, Republican representing Barron County. They're both members of the state assembly, and they're both on a key education committee there. Before we go back to our callers, I want to get into the school's voucher program. Representative Quinn, in his budget proposal, Governor Evers wants to freeze enrollment in the state's voucher programs. This has been a contentious issue. What are you looking at when it comes to the state's voucher system?
Yeah, I've always been a proponent of school choice. I mean, I was fortunate enough that my mom volunteered enough hours and worked enough jobs to allow us to get a K through 8 Catholic education, even though there was nothing wrong with my local public school. It was a decision our family made. But back in that day, she would not have qualified. She didn't make enough money. You know, we lived in our grandparents' home, but she made it work. And most people say that, yeah, you should pay for it on your own. But it's easy to say that when you have money. So I've always believed in choice. Obviously, yes, we need accountability, but I trust parents to make the right decision on where their child should go to school, even if they don't have the money to do so.
And Representative Considine, school vouchers.
We're back to priorities in the budget. We can't afford two parallel school systems. That's just not a possibility. I know I have a private voucher school in my district. They do a great job. They expanded their enrollment 100% last year. Mostly with students who were already going there, who were paying $4,000, give or take, in tuition. And the state gives them close to $7,000, and the school can't even use that because we prevent them from using it. It's just sitting there in an account. That's not a good expenditure of funds. I think parents should be able to make that choice. But especially if it's based on religious reasons, which Representative Quinn mentioned, I'm not sure that public schools or schools, public money, should be used to educate our children with religious education.
Representative Quinn, what do you think about that?
Yeah, and I think that is the one legitimate point people can have a discussion around in school choice. I think a lot of the other arguments fall flat, but I do openly admit that that is a actual philosophical debate we should have. Should public dollars ever flow to a private institution like that? But, you know, the Supreme Court has ruled on more than one occasion that it is acceptable.
Since you're both representing in part rural districts, I wanted to get into an issue we've touched on a little bit, trying to level the playing field for those schools in rural areas with declining enrollment to still compete for teachers. There was talk, Representative Quinn, not that long ago about sparsity aid. I think that ended up going through. What kind of aid is there from the state to help recruit teachers to those districts that maybe can't afford to pay as much, and do we need more of that?
Well, my first session, we took a bill that allowed for loan forgiveness just in the Milwaukee School District, and we opened it up to allow for teachers to apply in rural areas as well. You know, it's always hard to target monies and programs because you have haves and have-nots, and how do you convince other representatives to care about areas that they don't represent? So that's always the challenge for Representative Considine and others like myself in rural areas to make that case. But again, you know, rural schools are different. You know, the sparsity aid comes in, the high cost transportation. You know, we may spend the same amount or get the same aid, but if I spend $1,500 just to get the kid to the door and you only spend $500 to get the kid to the door, think of the educational disparities that exist just in transportation. So, but again, there's also issues in urban schools and issues in suburban schools. So it's, again, finding that balance, what is the right solution, having these conversations, and we've been having them. So I think there's going to be a lot of good that comes out of this budget for that.
And Representative Considine, if you could wrap it up for us by some of the issues you see along those lines with rural schools.
I think the first thing, and I mentioned it in the first phone call, we really need to increase respect for the people in the education community. I think that'll help rural, urban, and suburban schools. But one of the ways we do that is by sufficient pay. The competitive nature that we have in teachers right now is really killing rural school districts. I know of one rural school district, a very small district, the industrial council teacher there, arts teacher, makes $45,000 a year in total compensation. He had a first year student teacher taught with him, 6 months of experience in the classroom with him, or 4 months, as the case may be. And Waukesha Public Schools could afford to pay him a starting salary of $70,000, including benefits. That's killing rural schools. We have to find a balance. There's no way there should be that discrepancy in funding.
We'll leave it there for now. Representative Considine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. And My pleasure.
Representative Quinn, thanks for joining us on the show again.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've been talking to Republican Romaine Quinn and Democrat Dave Considine. They're both assembly representatives. We've been looking at school funding and policies in the state. If there are other education issues affecting schools in your area that you think need more attention, you can let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up, we'll learn about new legislation introduced in the U.S. Senate aimed at raising the federal age to buy tobacco products from 18 to 21 years. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced last Thursday that he'll introduce new legislation to raise the federal legal smoking age from 18 to 21 years. The legislation, if passed, would cover the sale of all tobacco products. That includes cigarettes and cigars, as well as vape pens and e-cigarettes. The stated goals of the legislation are to prevent younger people from getting hooked on tobacco early in their lives. But some public health officials aren't entirely on board with the plan. Our next guest is here to talk about the proposal and what it could mean for public health. Dr. Patrick Remington is professor and associate dean of public health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back. Thanks.
Well, what's your reaction to this idea? You've been following smoking and smoking laws for a long time. What do you see here?
Well, it is interesting. I think 12 states as of today have enacted age 21 laws for smoking. Six of them have taken effect, and the rest take effect. And actually, the Arkansas takes effect tomorrow. So this is something that public health has advocated, that raising the age does reduce teen tobacco use. And we know that when people start at a younger age, they're less likely to be able to quit, and they're more likely to die as a result of their cigarette smoking. But I think the devil's in the details on the bill. The bill hasn't been seen yet, and people aren't commenting about what else might be in the bill. So I think generally public health advocates would be in favor of raising the age for purchase. But it's really important to know what else comes along in that bill.
And that's a concern I've seen for tobacco researchers, public health advocates, that it'll be this instead of some of the other things people are looking for, more increases on taxes for things like that, restrictions on flavors, especially for e-cigarettes that seem to be targeting minors. Are you worried that that kind of thing wouldn't be in a program like this?
Well, I think it's important to understand when the Senate Majority Leader introduces this and it's supported by the industry, then you begin to wonder, why would an industry be supporting something that could cut into their sales to cigarette consumers and to their profits? And so I suspect that what will come in the bill is language that in the long run will make it more difficult for communities to address tobacco within their own specific community. And that comes by way of what we call preemption, that federal law often preempts states from doing anything that is not in strict compliance with the federal law. State law often predicts preempts communities from doing anything that's not consistent with the state law. And it's called leveling the playing field so that all the policies across the country would be the same, so that somebody trying to buy cigarettes is going to have the same success or failure in any state. But oftentimes, the preemption allows you to take away the right of communities to be able to decide for themselves whether they want to sell a product with flavoring, if they want to be able to tax a product or do other things that might be good for their community.
Setting the laws aside for the moment, let's talk about younger smokers. How important a part of the story is it when people are starting to smoke under the age of 21?
Well, when I heard about this bill and thought about coming here today, I wanted to do my own research. It's important to differentiate between what we think about something and what we know. And I was surprised to find that the Institute of Medicine, the National Academy of Science, did almost a 400-page study on the question of what happens when you raise the age of selling cigarettes to 21. And that extensive analysis shows that consumption by teens does go down. Teens 18 to 20 years of age, who now under this law would not be able to buy cigarettes legally, are less likely to consume. You also see consumption dropping in younger teens, those 15, 16, 17. And the theory or the observation is that you really take away the supply, that kids don't necessarily always buy cigarettes, underage purchases, that they often get them from their friends. And so by making it harder for 18, 19, 20-year-olds to buy cigarettes, you make it even harder for younger kids. And we know, to get back to your question, we know that anybody who starts smoking earlier is more likely to be harmed in the long run. And so one major public health strategy is if you can't prevent kids from smoking, you want to delay the age of onset, the age that people become regular smokers, because that's going to make quitting down the road much easier.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about a proposal from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to raise the legal smoking age, the age to buy tobacco products, including e-cigarettes, from 18 to 21. Let's talk about the e-cigarettes a little bit. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think tobacco numbers for youth had been going down over the years. Anecdotally, I hear a lot about various e-cigarette products showing up at schools and maybe being a road to nicotine addiction for kids. What are you seeing? What is the evidence out there so far?
Well, the evidence is it's too early to tell what the long-term impact will be, both on kids who are consuming e-cigarettes and on the population. Experience in Europe with a very similar product called Snus, which was a safer smokeless tobacco product, was that as Snus consumption increased, and in some Scandinavian countries it increased to 40 or 50% of kids, that smoking rate, smoke tobacco, plummeted precipitously. And the evidence is that there were actually many lives saved in those countries substituting a less harmful product for a more harmful product. So this sense of harm reduction, certainly e-cigarettes and snus are harmful, but they're less harmful than cigarettes. And it could be down the road that the dramatic decline that was seen in Europe is going to happen in this country, fewer and fewer kids being addicted to cigarettes, albeit at the cost of being addicted to nicotine through e-cigarettes.
Is there a thought that there might be a group of kids who would not have done either, would not have had any exposure to nicotine, starting with e-cigarettes, these flavored e-cigarettes, as what they perceive as a harmless alternative?
Well, that's the question. We would like to study that in a randomized experiment to, you know, split up a school, let's say, a grade school or a high school into two groups and really get to know the answer to that question.
We can't
do that. So we don't know. We'll know the results of this experiment in 5 or 10 years in this country. But I think many people who are really studying harm reduction expect that we will see fewer cigarette smokers, albeit at the cost of kids being more likely to be addicted to nicotine. But again, there are things that you can do to discourage kids from using both cigarettes and e-cigarettes, and increasing the age, legal age of purchase is one way. The other thing is to think about the products and what's in the product. Do you really need bubblegum flavored e-cigarettes? Do you really need these flavors, which are harmful in and of themselves and obviously are intended for kids?
I've heard people advocating for, if not the federal government, communities, states or cities, to restrict the sale of those flavors, to restrict their availability, especially to minors. Is that something you've seen?
Well, we have seen that. There are about 450 communities, and again, I mentioned 12 states, that have put restrictions on the sale of cigarettes. But again, I think we're likely to see, when this bill comes out, we're likely to see preemption language. Few people know that Wisconsin in 1987 was the first state in the nation to preempt local ordinances in tobacco. We thought we had a major success by raising the cigarette excise tax and by having a clean indoor air law. But what was slipped into Wisconsin's law, the first, again, in the country, was language preempting communities from doing anything that was not in strict compliance with state law related to kids, related to the sale or advertising to kids. And so for the last 30 years, we've been unable to have local approaches to tobacco control because of this preemption language.
We're talking to Dr. Patrick Remington right now. He's a professor and associate dean of public health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's with us to talk about Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's proposed legislation that would raise the federal legal age to buy tobacco products, including e-cigarettes, from 18 to 21 years old. A lot of details of what that would look like, not available yet. We'll go to your calls now. Chip is with us in Milwaukee. Chip, hello.
Hey, good conversation, and I appreciate Dr. Remington's concern about the nature of legislation being all in the details. But I wanted to get his input also on the concept of raising the exposure rate of younger brains to nicotine, because as we know, the brain is still evolving, still maturing, maybe as late as 25 years of age. And does he think that the delay in exposure might be advantageous to reduce the addictive nature of it because the brain is more mature?
Chip, thanks for the call. Teen brains and addiction, Dr. Remington.
Well, there's no question that the teen brain is susceptible to nicotine, and it can change one's really addictive potential over their life course. So I would clearly say that anything that can be done to avoid the use of nicotine, particularly at the younger ages, but even before the age of 25, is good for public health. But I think the challenge is that what we'd really like to do is reduce smoking, because that's the product that kills close to 500,000 people a year. And nicotine addiction is really the agent that keeps people smoking cigarettes. So I like to separate the two. Clearly, nicotine is a harmful product. It's harmful in e-cigarettes and in smoked cigarettes. But it's the people get lung cancer, people get heart disease and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease from burned tobacco. And this policy to raise the age to 21 will definitely move in that direction. It's just a question of what comes along with the policy that might be intended to, in the long run, not be as good for public health.
Thanks for that call, Chip. We'll go down to Rusty in Stevens Point. Rusty, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. First off, I'm not a smoker, and I never have been, and I'm not promoting that. But what I am looking at is the legality of the fact that at 18 years old, a person can legally own a store and sell the products that you're telling that person they cannot use. I think there's way too many rules and laws on the books already that don't get enforced, and I really think that I'm not sure that what they're going to do is totally correct.
Rusty, thanks for the call. And we also heard from Nathan on Facebook, who wrote, so we trust people to vote, marry, join the military, We don't trust them to make decisions on the personal use of alcohol or tobacco. This is a common argument against raising ages of vices, if you will, to 21, Dr. Remington.
Well, this is the balance that you play in the public discourse. Is a problem sufficient enough to really be paternalistic, take away an individual's adult? They're adults, and they should be able to decide what's good for them or what's not good for them. And society decides, no, we're going to pass a law that makes it illegal. So I think it's a very understandable pushback, and it comes at the point where is the harm to the public, again, almost a half million people dying from cigarette smoking, is that so much that we now have to have a policy that everyone would agree is very paternalistic? 18-year-olds should be able to, they can vote, you can go to war, and we're telling them they can't. They're not old enough to know about cigarette smoking. So that's a very valid complaint, but it's a discussion that we should have in society. And if the general consensus is this is a big enough public health problem, then we take away that right.
Thanks a lot for the call, Rusty. We'll go now to Natasha in Minocqua. Natasha, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Hi, what do you want to tell us about, Natasha?
Just wanted to comment. I'm a former smoker, started around 18. I use electronic cigarettes now. They have definitely made me feel better. My gums are not bleeding, for one, and I can run. But I wish I had legislation banning me from getting those cigarettes at 18, because I probably would not have such a nicotine addiction now.
Do you think you wouldn't have tried to get around the rule, get an older buddy or something to buy them for you?
I would have occasionally, but I would not have done it for like a pack-a-day habit.
All right, Natasha, thanks for the call.
And I think that personal experience is seen in the research, that there are effects. Now, they're not significant. They're modest effects. Smoking rates go down a few percentage points because it turns out that people do have other ways of getting cigarettes. Through friends, through social, other social sources. So, but it does impact some people, and there is. The result from this study was that you do see fewer smokers and more lives saved.
Natasha, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about smoking laws and tobacco laws. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says, hey, let's raise the national legal tobacco age from 18 to 21. Dr. Patrick Remington is with us from UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Let's go back to our callers now. Keenan is with us in Wausau. Keenan, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I agree with the guy that said there's too many laws in the books. I really do. But I started when I was 12. And, I mean, regardless, maybe in spite or despite of the fact that our brains are still maturing, which is just the basic thing that, you know, you start a bad habit when you're a little boy or a child, basically a 12-year-old, to give up any habit that you've carried that long in life, it's just drastically harder than if you were 21, in my opinion. I mean, cigarettes are so harmful, and we really need to just stay away from that for the children's sake.
And Keenan, I got to ask, you started at 12. Have you successfully quit?
You know, I've tried many times, and I've gone a few days here and there over the years, but no, I smoke to this day, and it's the only thing that I really hate about myself is just the cigarettes, the addiction, the financial costs, that I'm a big biker, the toll that it's taken on my body, the fact that kids see me smoking, just the pollution. I never throw cigarette butts out on the ground, but just the idea and then the hatred, you know, just people's animosity towards it. I don't blame them. We all have bad habits, though. But, I mean, realistically, I think this is a good law. I really do. And, I mean...
Keenan, thanks a lot for sharing your story. And I want to digress here a little bit, Dr. Remington. For smoking cessation, I've heard again and again, just because you quit and started again, it's not a failure. A lot of people have said it's your first step toward the time where it's going to work. So if somebody like Keenan keeps trying, he might succeed.
There's no question that success is attempting. Even expressing an interest in wanting to quit is success. The other issue is that there are many alternatives to smoking. The evidence from a recently published New England Journal study is that e-cigarettes are actually more effective than some of the pharmaceuticals available to help people quit. And going from smoked cigarettes to e-cigarettes is definitely good for your health. It's harm reduction, and it's a step in the right direction.
Keenan, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck if you're going to give it another shot. Time for another call. I think Ron is with us in Madison. Ron, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I graduated from high school when I was 65. I'm a family of eight, including my parents. My sister and I are the only ones who never smoked, except secondhand. But I thought about it because it was cool. But when you think about it, it makes it look kind of intellectual. I was thinking about smoking a pipe. My twin brother quit a four-pack-a-day habit when it was too expensive, cold turkey. But it's tough. And the thing is, I'm in favor of actually, my ancestral's plantation was a tobacco farm. I hope they grow something else now. But
I'm going to jump in, Ron, because we're just about out of time. But Ron brought up an issue there, his twin brother quitting finally because it was too expensive. That's another angle we haven't talked about too much, the impact of taxes, tobacco taxes on smoking rates.
Well, I think this and the previous caller make a point that when something's as harmful as cigarette smoking, we do in society put a lot of pressure on people not to smoke. We raise the price. We make it socially unacceptable. We make few places where you can smoke, and now we raise the legal age. And those are all intended to be good for public health, but it's really hard for people who got addicted as a kid and continued to smoke. You heard his pain from saying that, you know, he hates himself for being a cigarette smoker. So we really need to continue to do everything we can to prevent smoking. Raising the age is one thing we can do, but we also need to help support smokers who are trying to quit. Do everything we can to help them in their struggle to get off of nicotine.
And some compassion along the way, it sounds
absolutely.
Like. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor and Associate Dean of Public Health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us today to talk about proposed legislation that would raise the minimum federal age to buy tobacco products, including vape pens and e-cigarettes, from 18 to 21 years old. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.